Look, Lobsang, here are some books with utterly fascinating illustrations. It shows how to do certain operations, it shows how to operate those machines outside. We must set to work to try to understand this because we may be able to benefit the world if this ancient science can be revived. I looked at some of the books, and they seemed pretty gruesome to me. Pictures of people's insides, of people with the most fearful wounds one could imagine, wounds so bad that one could not even imagine them. But I decided I would stick to it and I would learn all I could about the human body. But first I came to the firm conclusion that food was necessary. One can't exercise the brain without a supply of food, and I voiced my thoughts on the matter. The Lama laughed and said, "Just what I was thinking about. That treatment has made me ravenously hungry, so let's go in this kitchen place and see what there is. We are either going to have to live on fruit or we shall have to break one of our rules and eat meat." I shuddered, and felt quite sick. Then I said, "But master, how can we possibly eat the flesh of an animal?" "But, good gracious me, Lobsang, the animals have been dead millions of years. We don't know how old this place is, but we do know that it is in remarkably good repair. It's better for us to eat some meat and live than just be purists and die." "Master, how is this place in such a good condition if it is a million years old? It doesn't seem possible to me. Everything wears out, but this place might have been vacated yesterday. I just don't understand it, and I don't understand about Atlantis." "Well, there is such a thing as suspended animation. In fact, these people, the gardeners of the earth, were subject to illnesses just the same as we are. But they could not be treated and cured with the crude materials available on this earth, so when a person was really ill and beyond the skill of the gardeners on this earth, then the patients were encased in plastic after having the treatment of suspended animation. In suspended animation, the patient was alive, but only just. A heartbeat could not be felt, and certainly no breath could be detected, and people could be kept in that state alive for up to 5 years. A ship came down every year to collect these cases and take the sufferer away for treatment in special hospitals in the home of the gods. When they were repaired, they were as good as new. Master, how about those other bodies, men and women, each one in a stone coffin? I am sure they are dead, but they look alive and they look healthy. So what are they doing here, what are they for?" "The gardeners of the earth are very busy people. Their overseers are even more busy, and if they wanted to know about the real conditions among the earthlings, they just took over one of these bodies. Their own astral form entered one of these bodies, they are just cases really, you know, and activated the body. And then one could be a man of 30, or whatever age suited, without all the bother and mess of being born and living a childhood and perhaps taking a job, and even taking a wife. That could lead to a lot of complications. But these bodies are kept in good repair, and always ready to receive a soul which would activate them for a time, and they would respond to certain stimuli and the body would be able to move under perfect control at the will of the new and temporary occupant of the body case. There are quite a number of these what we call transmigration people about. They are here to keep a check on the humans and try to avert and redirect some of the violent tendencies of these people. I find this utterly fascinating and almost unbelievable. And how about the bodies on the top of the Potala, the ones that are encased in gold, are they to be used as well?"
"Oh dear me, no," said the Lama. "These are humans of a superior type. And when the body dies, the ego moves on to higher realms. Some go to the astral world where they wait about, studying some of the people in the astral world, but I shall have to tell you more about this and about the realm of Patra. So far as I am aware, it is only we Tibetan lamas who know anything about Patra, but it's too big a subject to be rushed. I suggest that we look around a bit because this is quite a large cave complex." The Lama moved away from me to put some books back on the shelves, and I said, "Isn't it a pity to leave such valuable books on shelves like this? Would it not be better for us to take them back to the Potala?" The Lama Minyadon up gave me a peculiar look, and then he said, "I grow more and more amazed at how much you know at your very young age, and the Dalai Lama has given me full permission to tell you anything that I think you should know." I felt quite flattered at that. But the Lama went on, "You were present at the interview with those English soldiers. One was called Bell, and the Dalai Lama was absolutely delighted that you did not tell even me about it, what was said, what was done. I deliberately pressed you, Lobsang, to try you out for keeping secrets, and I am very pleased with the way in which you have responded. In a few years Tibet will be conquered by the Chinese. They will strip the Potala of all the things that made it the Potala. They will take away the golden figures and just melt down those figures for the gold they contain. Sacred books and books of learning will be taken to Peking and studied because the Chinese know that they can learn a lot from us, so we have places of concealment for the more precious things. You would not have found this cave except by the merest chance, and we are going to obliterate the side of the mountain so the merest chance cannot be repeated, and, you see, we have tunnels interconnecting for more than 200 miles, and the Chinese could not travel in their four-wheeled machines, and they certainly could not travel on foot, whereas to us it is just a 2 days' journey. In a few years Tibet will be invaded but not conquered. Our wiser men will go up into the highlands of Tibet and they will live underground in much the same way as the people who escaped before live in the hollow part of this world. Now, don't get excited because we are going to discuss these things. The Dalai Lama says there is no hurry for us to get back. I've got to teach you as much as I can about as many things as I can, and we shall rely upon these books a lot. To take them back to the Potala would merely be to put them in the hands of the Chinese, and that would be a sorry fate indeed. Well, I think it is time for us to carry out a systematic search of this particular cave, and we will draw a map of the place." "No need to, sir," I replied. "Here is a map in the minutest detail." Chapter 4. The Lama Minyadon Up looked exceedingly pleased, and he was even more pleased when I pointed out maps of several other caves. I had been rummaging around on a shelf and marveling that there was not a speck of dust anywhere, and there, well, I would call it a paper, but actually it was some substance like paper, only very, very much finer. Our paper was all handmade stuff from papyri. But I picked up this pile of paper and saw that there were maps and charts. First there was a very small scale map showing an area of about 250 miles, and then the tunnel was marked out with certain breaks in the line to show where it was no longer passable and one would have to get out of our own tunnel and look for the entrance to the other one. It was shown on the map all right, but how many earthquakes had made the map inaccurate, that was the problem. But then the next map was a chart of the cave in which we were now ensconced. LT showed all the rooms, and I was amazed at the number of rooms, and the cupboards and rooms were all labeled, but, of course, I couldn't read any of it. My guide, though, could. We laid the map on the floor and lay down on our dummies, while we looked at it. "Lobsang," said the Lama, "you have made some remarkable discoveries on this trip, and it is going to count very heavily in your favor. I brought a young Kila here once and he was quite afraid to even enter the cave. You see, the old hermit who fell to his death was actually the keeper of the entrance, and now we shall have to build a fresh hermitage to guard the entrance." "I think we hardly need a guardian, sir," I said, "because the whole of the tunnel through which we entered is blocked apparently through the earthquake shaking a whole sheet of rock, and that slipped down to cover this entrance. Were it not for these maps we could be stuck here forever." The Lama nodded gravely, and got to his feet and walked along beside the shelves looking at the books, reading their titles. Then, with an exclamation of delight, he pounced on one book. Oh, it was a massive thing, a great big fat book, looking as though it had just been made. "A dictionary, Lobsang, of the four languages used. Now we are well away." He picked the book up and again brought it to the floor. LT needed the floor to take all the charts. The table would have been too small. But the Lama went rustling through the pages of the dictionary and then, making notes on the chart of our particular cave, he said, "Centuries and centuries ago there was a very high civilization, far higher than the world has reached since, but unfortunately there were more earthquakes and seaquakes, and some lands sank beneath the waves and, according to this dictionary, Atlantis is not just one sunken continent. There was one in the sea which they called Atlantic, and there was another one lower down in the Atlantic. It was a place where there were many high peaks, and those peaks still protrude above the waters, and now they are called islands. I can show you on the map just where it is. He rustled around among the papers and then produced a great big colored sheet of paper. Then he pointed out the seas and the places where Atlantis had been. Then he continued, "Atlantis, the lost land, that is the real meaning of the word. LT is not a name like Tibet or India, it is a generic term for the lost land, the land which sank without trace." We maintained silence while we looked at those charts again. I was anxious to know how to get out of the place. The Lama was anxious to find certain rooms. At last he straightened up and said, "There, Lobsang, there. In that room there are wonderful machines which show us the past and right up to the present, and there is a machine which shows the probable future. You see, with astrology, for example, you can foretell what is going to happen to a country. But when it comes to foretelling one particular person, well, that takes a genius of an astrologer, and you had such a genius astrologer forecast your future, and it is quite a hard future indeed. Let us explore some of the other rooms first, because we want to spend a long time in the machine room where the machines can show us what happened since the first people came to this world. In this world, they have many peculiar beliefs, but we know the truth because we have been able to tap into the Akashic record and the Akashic record of probabilities. That is, we can foretell accurately what will happen to Tibet, what will happen to China, and what will happen to India. But for the individual, no, the record of probabilities is very much probability, and not to be taken too seriously." "Master," I said, "I am absolutely confused, because all the things I have learned have taught me that there is dissolution, paper should crumble to dust, bodies should crumble to dust, and food, after a million years, well, that certainly should have crumbled to dust, and I just cannot understand how this place can be a million or so years old. Everything looks new, fresh, and I just cannot understand it." The Lama smiled at me, and he said, "But a million years ago there was a much higher science than there is today, and they had a system whereby time itself could be stopped. Time is a purely artificial thing, and is used only on this world. If you are waiting for something very nice, then it seems an awful long time that you have to wait for it, but if you have to go to a senior Lama to have a good telling off, well, it seems no time before you are in front of him listening to his opinion of you. Time is an artificial thing, so that people can engage in commerce or in everyday matters. These caves are isolated from the world, they have what I can only call a screen around them, and that screen places them in a different dimension, the fourth dimension where things do not decay. We are going to have a meal before we explore further, and the meal will be of a dinosaur which was killed by hunters 2 or 3 million years ago. You will find it tastes quite good." "But master, I thought we were forbidden to eat meat." "Yes, the ordinary persons are forbidden to eat meat. It is considered quite adequate that they live on tsampa, because if one gorges oneself on meat, then one's brains get clogged. We are having meat because we want the extra strength which meat alone can give, and anyway, we have very little meat, mostly we have vegetables and fruits. But you may rest assured that eating this meat will not harm your immortal soul." With that he got up and went into the kitchen store, and he came out with a big container which had a most horrible picture wrapped around it. It showed what I imagined to be a dinosaur, and outlined in red was a marking showing what part of the dinosaur was in the canister. The Lama did some things to the canister, and it came open. I could see that the meat inside was absolutely fresh. It might have been killed that day, it was so fresh. "We are going to cook this, because cooked meat is much better than the raw stuff, so you'd better watch what I do." He did some queer things with some of the metal dishes, and then he tipped the contents of the canister into one of those metal dishes and slid it into what looked like a metal cabinet. Then he shut the door and turned some knobs so that little lights came on. He said, "Now, in 10 minutes, that will be perfectly cooked, because it is not cooked on the flame, but it is heated from the inside to the outside. It is some system of rays which I do not profess to understand. But now we must Look about for some suitable vegetables which will go well with meat. But however did you learn all this, master? I asked.
Well, I have traveled quite extensively and I have picked up knowledge from the Western world and I see how they prepare a special meal on the seventh day of the week. I must confess that it tastes really good, but it needs vegetables, and I think we have them here.
He put his hands deep into a closet and pulled out a long canister. He put it on the work shelf and carefully studied the label, then he said, "Yes, here are the vegetables and we have to put them in the oven for 5 minutes cooking." At that instant one light went out.
"Ah," said the lama, "that is a signal, we must push these vegetables in now." So saying, he went to the oven thing, opened the door, and slid in the complete canister, and then he quickly shut the door. Then he adjusted some of the knobs on the top, and a different light came on.
"When all these lights go off, Lobsang, our meal will be perfectly prepared. So now we have to get plates and those other fearsome implements that you saw, sharp knives and metal things with little bowls at the end, and those other things which have 4 or 5 spikes at the end, they're called forks. I think you are going to enjoy this meal." Just as he finished speaking the little lights flickered, dimmed, and were extinguished.
"There you are, Lobsang. Now we can sit on the floor and have a good meal." He moved forward to the hot place which he called an oven, and carefully he slid aside the door. The smell was beautiful and I watched with the keenest anticipation as he took the metal dishes off the shelves. He ladled out a good portion of everything for me, and then not so much for himself.
"Start in, Lobsang, start in. We've got to keep your strength up, you know." There were dishes, different colored vegetables, none of which I had ever seen before, and then this bigger dish with a big lump of dinosaur meat on it. Cautiously I held the meat with my fingers until the lama told me to use a fork to hold the meat, and showed me how. Well, I cut off a piece of the meat, looked at it, smelt it, and put it in my mouth. Quickly I rushed to the sink in the kitchen and got rid of the meat in my mouth. The lama was roaring with laughter.
"You're quite wrong in your thoughts, Lobsang. You think I am playing a trick on you but I am not. In some parts of Siberia the local people sometimes dig up a dinosaur which has been caught in the permafrost and frozen so solid that it might take 3 or 4 days to thaw. They eat dinosaur meat with the greatest of pleasure. Well, they can have my share of this with even greater pleasure for me. I thought I was poisoned. What vile stuff is. I would just as soon eat my grandmother than that mug." Carefully I scraped the last remnants of the meat from my plate, and then looking dubiously at the vegetables I thought I would try some. To my astonishment they tasted very, very good indeed. Mind you, I had never tasted vegetables before, all I had ever had to eat before this occasion was sampa and water to drink. So now I had a goodly helping of everything until the lama said, "You'd better stop, Lobsang. You've had a really big meal, you know, and you are not used to these vegetables. This first time they may keep you on the run. They will go through you like a purge and I will give you a couple of tablets which will calm your disturbed stomach." I swallowed the wretched tablets and they seemed as big as pebbles. After I had swallowed the things the lama looked and said, "Swallow them like that, eh? The usual way is to wash them down with a good drink of water. Have a go at it now. Fill up your cup with water and that will wash away the powdery taste." Once again I got to my feet and went into the kitchen. Tottered into the kitchen would be a better explanation because never in my life having had vegetables or fruit, well, I could feel alarming churnings inside me, so alarming, in fact, that I had to put down my cup and rush, run all the way, to that little room with the hole in the floor. A couple more feet and I should have been too late. However, fortunately I reached that hole just in time. I returned to the lama and said, "There are many things really puzzling me, and I just cannot get them out of my mind. For example, sir, you say this place might be 2 million years of age, then how is it that the vegetables and the fruit are quite palatable?" "Look, Lobsang," responded the lama, "you must remember that this world is millions of years of age, and there have been many, many different types of people here. For example,
About 2 million years ago there was a species of creature on the Earth and they were known as Homo habilis. They came into our era by inventing the first tools of this particular cycle. You see, Homo sapiens is what we are, and we are derived from that other Homo which I have just told you about. To try to make you understand a bit more, let me say that the world is like a garden, and all the buildings in the world are plants. Well, every so often the farmer will come along and he will plow his garden. That means that he will turn up the soil, and in so doing he will upset all the plants and the roots. They will be exposed to the air for a few minutes, and then as the plow comes over again they will be buried more deeply so that in the end no one could tell that there had been such and such a plant in that garden. It is the same with humans on the world, think of us as the plants. But the humans of different types are tried out and if they cannot manage to the satisfaction of the gardeners then catastrophes and disasters will be their lot. There will be mighty explosions and earthquakes, and every trace of humanity will be buried, buried deep beneath the soil, and then a fresh race of people will appear. And so the cycle will go on, just as the farmer plows under the plants so the gardeners of the world caused such disasters that every trace of the habitations is shattered. Every so often a farmer will be busy with his patch of ground, and then he might spot something sparkling in the ground where he is digging, so he will bend over and pick it up, wondering what it is. And perhaps he will tuck it in the front of his robe to take home and show to his wife and perhaps to his neighbors. He might have dug up something which was buried a million or so years ago and now, with earthquakes, that piece of brilliant metal will have been brought to the surface. Sometimes a piece of bone will be discovered and the farmer will spend perhaps a couple of minutes wondering what sort of creature it came from because there have been some very queer creatures on this earth. There have been women, for instance, with a purple skin and 8 breasts aside just like a pregnant bitch. I suppose it would be quite useful to have the 16 breasts, but that race died out because it was impractical. If the woman had given birth to a lot of children her breasts would have become so pendulous that she would hardly be able to walk without falling over, so that race died out. And then there was another race whose men were about 4 feet tall, none taller than that, and they were born horsemen, not like you who can hardly sit on the tamest pony we've got. But these were extremely bow-legged and they had no need for stirrups or a saddle, or anything like that. Their natural body conformity seemed to have been designed especially for horse riding. Unfortunately the horse hadn't been invented at that time. "But, sir," I said, "I cannot understand how we can be in a mountain, right inside a mountain, and yet we have good brilliant sunlight and plenty of heat. It baffles me, and I cannot think of any solution." The lama smiled as he often smiled at some of my statements, and he said, "These rocks which we call mountains have special properties, they can absorb sunlight, and absorb it, and then, if one knows how, we can get the sunlight released to any degree of brightness that we need. As the sun is shining more or less all the time on the top of the mountains, well, we are always storing up sunlight for when the sun has gone about her journey and is beyond our vision. It is not at all a magical thing, it is a perfectly ordinary natural occurrence like the tides in the sea." "Oh, I forgot you had never seen the sea, but the sea is a vast body of water, it is not drinkable because it comes from fresh water which has run down a mountain side and across the earth bringing with it all sorts of impurities and poisonous subjects. And if we tried to drink the water it would hasten our death. So we have to use some of the stored sunlight. It falls on a special sort of plate, and then a cold draft of air plays on the other side of the plate, then the light manifests itself as heat on one side and cold on the other. The result of that is that droplets of water form, born of the light from the sun, and the cold from the earth. That will be absolutely pure water called distilled water. And so we can catch it in containers and then we have plenty of fresh drinking water. But, master, this business of having things a million or 2 million years old, well, I just cannot understand it all. The water for instance, we turned a metal thing and we got cold water which, obviously, had been put in a tank somewhere a million or so years ago. Well, how hasn't it evaporated? How can it possibly be drinkable after all these years? It's got me absolutely defeated. I know on the Potala roof the water tank would soon dry up, so how can this be a million years old?
Lobsang. Lobsang. You think we have a good science now, you think we know a lot about medicine and science, but to the outside world even we are just a bunch of uneducated savages. Yet we understand things that the rest of the world does not. The rest of the world is a materialistic group of people. This water might be a million or 2 million or 3 million years old in years, but until we came here and broke the seal and set everything working, well, it might have been just an hour or two before. You see, there is such a thing as suspended animation. We have heard a lot from other countries about people who have gone into a cataleptic trance for months, and there is one now which has already passed the year and a half mark, and the person looks none the worse for it. She looks no older, it is just, well, she is alive. We can't feel a heartbeat, we can't get any breath on a mirror, so what is keeping her asleep and why is it not doing her harm? There are so many things to be rediscovered. All these things were commonplace in the days when the gardeners came. Purely as an example, let me show you the room. Here it is on the chart. Look, where bodies were kept in a suspended life stage. Once a year two lamas would go and enter that room, and one by one they would take the bodies out of stone coffins and then examine the bodies carefully for any ills. If everything was all right, they would walk the bodies up and down to make their muscles work again. Then, after we had fed the bodies a bit, would come the task of putting the astral body of a gardener in the body taken from a stone coffin. It is a most peculiar experience.
What, sir? Is it really a difficult thing to do?
Now look at you, Lobsang, telling me on the one hand that you can't believe such a thing, and on the other hand you are trying to find as much information as you can.
Yes, it is a dreadful feeling. In the astral you are free to be whatever size it is most convenient to be. You might want to be very small for some reason, or you may want to be very tall and broad for some other reason. Well, you pick the right body and then you lay down beside it, and the lamas would inject a substance in the apparently dead body and gently they would lift you and put you face down on that body. Gradually, over a period of 5 minutes or so, you would disappear, you would get fainter and fainter, and then all of a sudden the figure in the stone coffin would give a jerk and sit upright and make some sort of explanation.
Oh, where am I? How did I get here?
For a time, you see, they have the memory of the last person to use that body, but within a matter of 12 hours the body that you had taken would appear to be absolutely normal, and would indeed be capable of all the things that you could do if you were on Earth in your own body. We do this because sometimes we cannot afford to risk damaging the real body. These simulacrum bodies, well, it doesn't matter what happens to them, they've only got to find someone with the right conditions about them and then we could put the body in a stone coffin and let the life force drift away to another plane of existence. People were never forced into it, you know, it was always with their full knowledge and consent. Later on you will inhabit one of these bodies for a year less a day. The day is because the bodies would only last 365 days without having certain intricate things happen to it. So it is better to have the takeover to last a year less one day. And then, well, the body which you are still occupying would get into the stone coffin, shuddering at the coldness of it, and gradually your astral form would emerge from the substitute body and would enter your own body and take over all its functions, all its thoughts, and all its knowledge. And on that now would be superimposed all the knowledge that you had gained during the past 364 days. Atlantis used to be a great exponent of this system. They had a great number of these bodies which were constantly being taken over by some super person who wanted to get a certain bit of experience. Then, having got the experience, they would come back and claim their own body and leave the substitute for the next person. But Master, I am honestly puzzled indeed by this because if a gardener of the world has all these powers then why cannot he just look east or west or south or north and see what is going on? Why all this rigmarole of occupying a substitute body?
Lobsang, you are being dim. We can't afford to have the real high personage damaged, we cannot have his body damaged,
and so we provide him with a substitute body, and if an arm or a leg be taken off, that's just too bad, but it does not hurt the high entity who took over the body.